This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you again in studio. My producer, Lee Delapina, also here, and we're ready to go for the next hour here in Lexington, Kentucky. For those of you just joining us throughout North America on Sirius Channel 93, welcome to the show, and welcome back to everyone that has been with Chad Summers, Anthony Stabile, and Sean Feld with our live racing coverage over the past 3 hours on XM 208. Of course, you can always tune in to HRN every time we're on the air with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. And I tell you this every time I open the show, but I'll say it again tonight: training racehorses is a 7 day a week, 365 day a year profession. There are no holidays. It takes an extraordinary amount of dedication, commitment, and perseverance, and tonight's guests exemplify that as much as any trainers I've had the chance to visit with on this program. And we're going to begin with trainer Pat Byrne. He's a native of London, England. He has saddled 432 career winners. They have earned more than $22 million in purses, bolstered by three Breeders' Cup winners, Favorite Trick and Countess Diana in 1997, and Awesome Again in 1998. Pat, welcome to Trainer Talk.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having us on the show.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And can you really believe that it's been 16 years since Awesome Again?
Yeah, it's man, that time's really gone around quickly. It's amazing.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It
sure is.
Doesn't seem like it's been that long. Of course, he's gone on to have a tremendous stud career as well. You have to be very proud of that.
Yeah, very proud. You know, it was disappointing he didn't get Horse of the Year. He really should have done. You know, put the voters in there. I don't know. Skipaway was voted in. I mean, he was a super nice horse, but I really don't think he should have been voted Horse of the Year over a horse like Awesome Again.
Well, and I can imagine after you guided him through that undefeated campaign and then beat Skipaway in the Breeders' Cup Classic, you had to be thinking, hey, we got this now.
Well, you know, I know Frank Stronach was certainly thinking that, and it's just one of those strange voting deals. But, you know, it's always nice to be in the mix when it comes to those kind of votes. And we were certainly happy to be nominated. But I just felt disappointed for the horse because the horse truly, you know, he was a really good racehorse. You know, he was the most soundest horse, but he was very, you know, if you had him feeling good, he was always right on the day. So, you know, we did a nice campaign with Space Nattie's races with the Breeders' Cup Classic in mind, and all the team did a fantastic job with him.
That was the 1998 Breeders' Cup Classic. The year before, in 1997, you arrived at the Breeders' Cup with Favorite Trick and Countess Diana. Before that Breeders' Cup, you described yourself as an overnight success, 20 years in the making. Where does that success story begin? And it's kind of a neat story.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, it's such a numbers game, thoroughbred horse racing, and I've never had a large stable of horses to contend with. I obviously have an opportunity to have a lot of numbers, you know, right around, you know, the late 90s. And, you know, when you have that kind of success, obviously you get garner a lot of attention from a lot of would-be owners. And it was my choice from a personal standpoint not to train a lot of horses. It's actually one of the reasons why I did go to work for Frank Stronach, because he was looking for a private trainer that was interested in training a lot of, you know, large numbers, meaning anything more than 25, 30 head of horses. You know, some of our more popular horse trainers in the country, they usually, you know, have 100 at least in training, 150, 200. So, and that's kind of a personality thing. And those guys do a fantastic job with it. It just wasn't my cup of tea, so to speak. And it just, my personality didn't suit, you know, all the overwhelming success and all that kind of attention. So, you know, I tend to be an under the radar kind of guy, and I've been happy training just a handful of horses. Even as we speak, Mike, I have between 8 and 10 in training. So it's always hard to come up with really top horses when you have that limited number of opportunities.
Yeah, you've been somebody that I've always said you do this for the love of the game. And that love started for you as a child. I know you dropped out of high school to get involved with working with horses, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I don't know if 15 in England was dropping out of high school. We finished... You know, I still don't know if I have a GED or no. That's what they call it in America. I believe I had a certificate of high school education in England. But, you know, I dropped out. Well, I'm pretty sure I completed my high school. But, you know, at the age of 15, why do we do that? It's because we want to be a jockey. And, you know, obviously if you hang around in high school to 16, 17, guess what? You're usually, you know, a little bit taller and a little bit heavier. So I was eager to start my apprenticeship in England, and I hooked on with a guy as an apprentice with a guy called Reg Akerst. I don't know if you're familiar with too many of the English trainers, but I started my apprenticeship back there with him in 1972, and I did 3 years with him, and then I ended up going to a couple of steeplechase outfits simply because I was too heavy to be a flat rider. But nevertheless, it was a great experience and a great opportunity, and I felt like it was great, you know, from the ground up horsemanship. It was a great learning experience from the age of 15.
Yeah, and I think I read somewhere that was at Lambourne. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right, Mike. Lambourne, England.
Yeah, and isn't that tied to some mystery novels too? Isn't there something there with Lambourne?
Yeah, actually, Dick Francis. Francis. And actually, when I was riding out for Frank Condell, a guy who actually I went to, he was a really incredible steeplechase trainer, and he's one of the tops at his time, Captain Frank Condell. And Dick Francis used to come and ride out in a set or two, and a string, as we call it, and I got to meet Dick Francis there. So he was a great character, and obviously a very colorful man with the turf writing on all the novels that he's produced over the years.
Yeah, that had to be pretty neat. And then you came to the United States, I guess, the late 70s, maybe around 78, and started working here.
I came over for the summer, and I hooked up with a really great guy called John Russell. John's passed on now, but he gave me my big break because, you know, when you just come over from England, you don't know anybody, and it's always a little bit scary. But he was more than nice and more, you know, very helpful to me getting my, you know, my American, you know, horsemanship started. So, and I spent the summer with him. You know, back in '78, obviously he trained for Mr. Phipps, and I had no idea the royal bloodlines, the horses that I was galloping at the time. For instance, horses like Private Account, who was just a two-year-old. I remember galloping a horse called Relaxing. She was the mother of Easy Goer. And we had, you know, every horse in the barn was just so steeped in blue blood pedigree. And it was a great experience.
Was that a big adjustment coming from England here to the States, or did you kind of fall into it?
Well, it was an adjustment for sure. But I was ready for a change. I was always ready for... you know, I'm the kind of guy that change is good, and I was excited about the opportunity to work around those kind of horses, and it worked out well. You know, obviously I had to go back to England and then come back over, and I went to California, and John Russell at the time had got onto a public stable and didn't have many horses in training, so I ended up connecting with a man called Tommy Doyle, who was from Ireland. And he had a very big, you know, he carried about 50, 60 horses, which was considered back then a large string of horses. Unlike now where you got guys with, you know, 150, 200.
Sure. Now, was that before going to work for Leroy Jolly and David Whiteley?
Yeah, that was, I was on the West Coast, and I actually got my green card over there with Tommy, so I was able to be, you know, legal. I mean, obviously at first you're not. But that's, you know, that's another story. But, you know, you know, you come over as a kid, you just gallop horses, you like it, you want to stay. You know, it's I guess it's been said I could be pulled into the great American dream, but I tend to try to work around some of the sharper guys in American racing, and I've been fortunate to have had the opportunity, especially with guys like Tommy, John Russell, you know, and later on, as you mentioned, Leroy Jolly. You know, he had Genuine Risk at the time and some really good horses that belonged to Burnt Iron Firestone. So there was some seriously good race horses there. And then, you know, spent a winter galloping for David Whiteley, another great horseman down there, you know, son of the great Frank Whiteley. And so we learned a lot from him, and I just kind of picked it up and just wanted to get an opportunity with a trainer to be an assistant and work from there. And Howie Tesher gave me that start there.
Yeah, it's interesting because so many trainers that I've talked to on this show, Pat, will always tell me that they've taken bits and pieces from everybody they've been around over the years, and that's what makes them the trainer they are today. Has that been the same for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you're gallop horses, or if you're, you know, ex-jock or ex-size boy or something like that, you can move around a little bit more than just being stuck with one guy as an assistant from the ground up. And obviously we've had lots of, you know, successful horse trainers, you know, like Wayne Lucas. He just turns out trainers by the dozen, it seems like. And, but, you know, if you're galloping horses, and I think you can just get that opportunity to move around a little bit and without being tied down for one guy for, you know, any number of years. And I think it's just a different style of approach of training. You can kind of get a handle on it.
Visiting with trainer Pat Byrne on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Pat, you decided to go out on your own in 1986. Why was that the right time to make that move?
Well, you know, finding owners is not the easiest thing in the world. And Howie Tesher, who I'd worked for, had been an assistant for several years. We had one guy, Pete Savin, which Pete and his wife Elaine. Pete has since passed on, unfortunately. But they gave me an opportunity. They had a bunch of homebreds, mostly Florida breds, and they had a connection with a horse called Distinctive Pro, which Pete's father was Butch Savin, who had, you know, initially had Mr. Prospector. So Pete was kind of looking for his own guy, and I think it presented an opportunity. You know, we had like 15, 20 horses. So I thought it was a good time. It was 1986, and I felt like I'd gone as far as I could go as far as being an assistant trainer. So when this opportunity presented itself, I took it.
Yeah, and things started off pretty well for you. You had 17 winners that first year, not too shabby.
Yeah, no, the thing was that was Pete liked to bet, and we just, you know, you just kind of ran horses where they needed to be, and, you know, and I know you know this, Matt, but I talked to a lot of trainers over the years. You know, if you have a horse worth 20,000, you run him for 10 or 15, you're going to be right there. You know, you take a horse that's worth 10,000, you run him for 20 or 30, you know, you're going to be middle of the pack type thing. So when you get a guy that likes to bet on his horses, you better cut him in half. I mean, it's no secret to that. You know, you have guys that, you know, we have prominent owners in the world, you know, racing today, very famous owners. They'll take a horse, like I said, $30,000 horse, they'll run him for 10 or 15. Just, you know, they're usually 6 to 5 favorite, and they usually win. So that's the rule of thumb on that.
Yeah, I like to bet, too. I wish I knew you back then.
Well, we take cash some bets. I don't gamble myself, but it's, you know, it's just, you know, you put, you know, the old adage, you just put the best horse in the worst race, and so, which is a little difficult to do with allowance and stake horses. So, you know, you're dealing with the cards you dealt with in that respect. So on one hand, the claiming game can be a little easy, you know, when you try to be like me, which I prefer not to do. And I've tried to base my career on developing young horses into stake horses. And again, that falls into the part where, you know, you need an opportunity, which means the more yearlings or two-year-olds you can put your hands on, the better opportunity you have of producing a nice allowance, you know, stake horse. So when you're sitting back there and you're dealing with, you know, half a dozen, six, seven, eight, two-year-olds every year, it's a little harder to do. but it's a good challenge. I enjoy it.
Well, not only did you get off to that good start in 86 in your first year of training, but the next year your business doubled, as did your number of wins. You went to 33 wins. Then things got a bit quieter for the next decade or so until 97 when everything kind of exploded. Yeah. How come?
Yeah. Well, you know, you just get, again, it's numbers. You know, when, you know, I'd never carried more than 15, 18 horses tops. The year I went to work for Frank Stronach privately, I had as many as, I think, 30 tops. So, again, it's a numbers game. It's opportunity. And then you just get, you know, you can just get real lucky. You just get a couple of good horses come to the barn. You know, we bought Favorite Trick because I really liked him in the two-year-old sale. We gave $100,000 for him for Joe Lacombe, a gentleman I trained for at the time. And then I had a client I trained for, Rick and Nancy Castor, and they just had a filly break an old 51-year-old track record at Laurel. Her name was Countess Diana, and of course, she was a stone runner. So trained by a good friend of mine, Carlos Garcia, who had the mare and owned part of the mare. And Carlos is a smart guy. He likes to, you know, he'll take money off the table by selling a horse if he was involved in. And, you know, I got Rick Castor to buy Carlos out, and he sent the filly to me. So that's, you know, those my two champions came around. So it's kind of, racing is very much a feast or famine kind of business. Obviously, if you keep a large outfit, the more numbers, the more opportunity you're going to get for keeping the wins. But you can certainly fall into a category where if you kind of bounce around, you know, 10, 12, 6, 8 kind of small outfit, it's really hard because, you know, one minute you walk in your barn and you've got, you know, two legs pointing the wrong way and, you know, this horse is sick, that horse is sick, and, you know, then you're out of business. So, it's a challenge for sure, but it suits my personality, and I'm okay with it.
Yeah, well, not many people, including the likes of Todd Pletcher, Steve Asmus, and Bob Baffert, the guys with the big stables, even those trainers won't often have the opportunity to train two champions in the same year, and you had that in 97, as you mentioned, with Favorite Trick and Countess Diana.
Yeah.
Look back on that year for a minute, Pat. How magical was that for you?
Well, it was really freaky, you know. I just lost my my father just passed 2 years before, and I just lost my mother the year before that. So it's kind of a magical situation. But you know, and then you know, obviously that opened up and got more opportunities to pick up some more clients, and that's you know, back towards the end of the '90s, I had an opportunity. I mean, I had so many clients. I mean, the world was my oyster, so to speak, and. You know, and I ended up working for Frank. So, you know, that kind of, you know, and then when Frank decided he wanted to do something else, you know, which was certainly his prerogative, you know, kind of took the rug from under my feet a little bit. And that's, when you get a small outfit, you just tough opportunity or a missed opportunity. And, you know, it's just tough to kind of bounce back from those kind of things.
Yeah, but even after that, after 97 and 98, things still stayed pretty good for you for the next few years until it started to quiet down again, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, we tipped along at a little steady pace. You know, I did some other things like real estate and that just on a personal level, which, you know, and I got the feeling I wasn't feeling good for a couple of years, so I really backed away from the business a little bit. You know, I was just so overwhelmed. I mean, people have no idea when you get caught up in those Breeders' Cup races, those big races. It's so, you know, it seems like everybody wants a piece of you, Mike, you know, the media and everything else. And that's part of the job. So, you know, any young trainer coming up that's getting, you know, in the limelight, so to speak, you know, you've got to be prepared for the media onslaught because it's very time-consuming. And, you know, it's kind of fascinating to be involved in that. And I always consider myself very fortunate to be in that position. So I'm always grateful for it. But it's tough. I mean, it's depending on your personality. It really, you know, you need to devote a lot to it because media is such a great part of the game. And the media, you know, like I say, I never forget standing at Hollywood Park with my British Cup horses. It's just like, the media would come along, and then I finally figured it out one morning, Mike. I was sitting in my office at Hollywood, and it was like 10 o'clock. I poked my head out the door, and it was like, you know, there'd be three people, four people. I'd conduct some interviews. And I finally got smart after a couple of days of that. I finally just waited until I had about 15, 20 media guys outside. Okay, guys, now we can talk, rather than just keep repeating myself. So it's fascinating how that all works and how time-consuming that can be.
Yeah, it's a great position to be in, but I can imagine that after so much of that, maybe you get a little bit burned out. Is that the right way to put it?
Oh, I got burned out for sure. I mean, I'll be the first one to admit, I got burned out for sure because, you know, and again, the owners, they expect so much. And, when you win and you win the big races, they expect you to keep winning the big races. And then you get horses that are nowhere near, you know, because the bottom line is the horse. And we don't give enough credit to the horse. I think I've been quoted more than once on this, Mike, that, you know, the horses do all the running, and it's really simple. The fast ones go fast, and the slow ones go slow. And, you know, people tend to start setting new horses that they all think they're champions, and they're just not. So, you know, I think, you know, what, 5% of all thoroughbreds are really, really good horses? So I'm not quite sure the percentage, but I like to call it around 5%, you know, maybe, you know,
sure.
10%. I'm not sure. But... And then you get, you know, you start getting a bunch of horses that don't run too fast, and all of a sudden, you know, you forget how to train. So it's a fickle business like that. Over the last several years, I've tended to train for people that are friends of mine. I've just kind of, got my business kind of good to that. And I think what that does is it takes, you know, people understand what you're going through, and people... You know, owners, they, you know, I've been through, I mean, I've been fortunate to train for pretty much everybody you can think of, you know, Colmore, Robert Sangster, who was great, got an opportunity to run a couple horses for Dolly when they bought out Stoner's Side. So, and I've had a lot of really, really good clients to work for over the years, and a lot of them have been more understanding than others, it's good. It's a fascinating business for sure.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about this on several occasions, Pat, but you've always referred to yourself as more of a manager and managing the horses. You talked about it earlier in the interview with putting them in the right spots. Is that kind of how you view your role as being a manager of horses?
Well, yeah, I mean, we do. I mean, obviously I do all the groundwork and the training and that, but, you know, the manager is the key point of when you get to the better the horse, the better you have to manage. And sometimes it's not so much where you run a stake horse, is where you don't run. And, you know, like a classic example is a horse called Awesome Again that we talked about earlier. You know, there was when we were going in that, getting ready for the Breeders' Cup Classic, there was a key race prior to that. And some of the gang went to run in the jockey club. And some of us, well, I particularly really wanted to go to the Hawthorn Gold Cup, and mainly on the weather. I was watching the weather with great, you know, great concern, and the race at Belmont came up really, really sloppy. A horse called Wagon Limit won the race, and I don't think he ever ran again. Skipaway ran in that race.
Sure.
I'm not sure where he was placed, but he didn't show up for the Classic because I don't think he was 100%. So by missing the jockey club, even though that's the race that probably cost us a vote or two for being horse of the year. I mean, some of the guys want to say, well, you ducked this race, you ducked that race. Well, Awesome Again never ducked anybody, and he certainly never ducked Skipaway, because when you take a horse to Saratoga, not once but twice, win the Whitney and win the other stake you run, you're not ducking anybody in Saratoga. So if you take a horse there twice, that was my answer to the New York vote. So, but the jockey club came up sloppy. It was a bad, you know, bad weekend. The track obviously wasn't that great. None of those horses came out to do any good. If I can honestly tell you this, if I had run Awesome Again in the jockey club, I don't think we would have been primed for the Classic at Churchill Downs.
Yeah.
So we went to Hawthorn. We were 1-5, Pat Day. We won nicely. We got a nice, you know. And the Hawthorn Gold Cup's a nice race. It's a grade two. It was $500,000. It's a nice race. It was the perfect prep for Awesome Again. So my point is, Mike, it's where you don't run as opposed to where you run. So it was just, if that's what cost us horse of the year, you know, that was just too bad. But we showed up in the Classic. Nobody else at Running the Jockey Club showed up in the Classic. And you can pull up those charts and you can check into that. But that was the story that came to mind about managing horses, especially when you're managing Grade One horses on that level.
Yeah, I think people will realize that your career has had as many ups and downs and highs and lows, peaks and valleys, whatever you want to call it, as any trainer out there. And I'm just kind of curious, Pat, when you're going through the down times and the slower times, is there ever a point when you say, you know what, maybe I need to do something else?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and like I said, I mentioned earlier, I wasn't feeling too good for a little while. I backed away from my business, and I think I was just kind of stressed out. At least that's what the doctors told me. They didn't find anything. I mean, I'm healthier now than I was 10 years ago. I can honestly tell you that. But I feel good, and it's just, but I always had real estate. I love dabbling in real estate. I mean, I don't have a real estate license. So I don't look to sell, you know. But I've given some of my friends some pointers, and I've just been very lucky. And I was flipping, you know, ocean condos without realizing what I was doing, you know, before the flip word came out. So that was just kind of a side thing for me, and I've done really well at it, and it, you know, it's put food on the table through the lean days of, you know, not having a lot of horses in training. So I've been very lucky in that respect.
Well, Pat, as so often happens with the interviews here on Trainer Talk, this half hour has flown by, just a couple of minutes left. So I always like to end by asking trainers to take us inside themselves, so to speak. And what do you like to do outside of horse racing when you're not at the racetrack?
Well, we talked about, one of them was real estate. Obviously, I like to do that. I work out quite a bit now, as opposed to which I didn't do years ago. You know, I run a lot more than I used to, so I'm pretty fit. And I think as we get older, I think that's part of, you know, just trying to maintain your health. And, since I've been divorced, I like to look at a lot of pretty women. So that's just as personal as I can get right now.
Now, when you say you're running, I'm not going to elaborate on the second part of that. But when you say you're working out and you're running, are you doing marathons? Are you doing those type of things, or is it just recreational?
Nothing on a professional level, just fun stuff, just enough to keep my mind ticking over, just to try and stay in shape, you know, because when you get up in your 50s, you got to look good.
Well, especially if you have your eyes on the two-legged fillies.
Absolutely.
Well, Pat, I can't thank you enough for being my special guest here tonight. It's been so much fun to hear your story. We could have talked for another half hour easy. There were things that we didn't even get to, so we'll have to do Pat Byrne Part 2 later up the road.
Well, that's probably a good thing. The things we didn't talk about. Okay, Mike. Well, it's great being on the show, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Pat, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You got it. Bye.
Trainer Pat Byrne. He's a playa. So much fun, and great to see him have that kind of success with small stables. You remember he had Take Charge Indy on the Derby trail, in the Derby, won the Florida Derby. That was a pretty cool story. I can remember talking to Pat right before the Florida Derby, and he was pretty excited about that horse. And for a guy that doesn't have many horses in training, you heard him say 10 or 11, 12 horses at the most, to have a horse in the Kentucky Derby is pretty remarkable. Fun stuff. The second half of Trainer Talk coming up next here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Stay tuned.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Phasic Tipton.
Where will you be this summer? The Phasic Tipton 2014 yearling sales will be here before we know it, so make plans now. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky will be held July 14th. In 2013, the sale boasted an average of more than $89,000 and a median of $72,000, and the percentage rate of return of 43% was the third highest of any yearling sale in North America. The Saratoga sale on August 4th and 5th is always one of the top international yearling marketplaces. The
sales $295,000 average in 2013, maintains its leadership role, and with the highest percentage of profitable yearlings among all sales in North America this past year, it's the only place to be this August. New York bred yearlings are in the spotlight August 9th and 10th in Saratoga, with a $430,000 average and major increases in both average and median in 2013. The New York bred sale is the most productive auction for the cream of the New York bred crop. So where will you be this summer?
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right. For the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
HRRN Live brings you live racing from tracks across the country. Join Chad Summers and the HRRN broadcast team as we bring you live racing every Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on our new channel, XM208, or streaming live online at horseracingradio.net. HRRN Live is your source for live thoroughbred racing from coast to coast, only on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Go to hrrnlive.com for a complete schedule of tracks and races.
This is Bob Baffert, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is the Horse Racing Radio Network, your home for racing's biggest events.
And welcome back to the show, Trainers Listen To. Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Of course, you can catch this show each and every Wednesday evening from 6 to 7 Eastern Time, Sirius 93, XM 208, and as always, streaming worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net. If you do miss any portion of the show live, you can go back and listen to a podcast on our website at your leisure. Again, that's horseracingradio.net. Our next special guest was bitten by the racing bug as a youngster growing up in Liverpool, England. He has trained a total of 536 winners in a career which currently spans more than 2.5 decades. Those runners have earned just shy of $14 million in purses. He is Phil Gleaves, and he is with us here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Phil, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Mike. Happy to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you on board and looking forward to hearing your story. And, you know, like so many other trainers, you started with horses at a very young age.
I did. My family was not involved in horses at all. None of my family. And I grew up in downtown Liverpool in the city. So there was no accessibility to horses. But from the age of 7, I just was enamored with watching them on TV. And I then started to learn how to ride them. I went to a local riding school in the suburbs and did chores in the stables to pay for riding lessons. And then I started working with horses and in shows, show jumping and eventing and things like that in my native city of Liverpool, England. And from there, I just... I wanted to go faster and faster. I would always pick the fastest pony in the stable to ride. And then the natural progression would be to become a jockey, because at the time I was very small.
Was that what your first choice would have been, would be a jockey as opposed to a trainer?
Yes, that was definitely my first choice. And I left school at 15. I got special permission from the mayor of the city of Liverpool to leave school at 15 because the school leaving age was 17.
Wow.
At the time, and I had to get special permission to leave school because it was important that I embark on this journey as soon as possible. My mom and dad were not totally for it, but they were supportive of it when they knew that my heart was really in this thing. And so I started to, I had my first mount as a jockey at 15, and ended up growing too big very quickly.
Yeah, so you kind of learned early on that you weren't going to be a jockey, right?
And that was heartbreaking. And that was about the age of 18. And I'd ridden some races in England and some races in Germany, and I did not know what to do. But I loved horses. I loved being around them. So I came to the United States primarily as an exercise rider.
Okay. And then that was what, in the mid-70s, is that right?
That would be 1977, and I was 19 years old, just getting ready to turn 20, and arrived on these shores. And it's funny how things work out. My mom has a cousin here who I've never met, and she met me at the airport, and her and her family took me in and made me feel very welcome. And at dinner that first night, she said, well, what are you going to do for a job? I said, I don't know. I'm going to maybe show up at Belmont tomorrow. She said, well, I'm going to bingo tonight, and my friend who I play bingo with, I think she knows somebody at Belmont. Anyway, long story short, it was a jockey's agent that my aunt's friend knew, and I met him at 5:30 the next morning at Belmont Park, and he took me over to Lucien Lauren's barn. And I started working galloping horses for Lucien Lauren in April of 77.
Wow, talk about being in the right place at the right time.
Yes, I believe in fate, I believe in destiny, and somebody up there was certainly looking after me. I stayed with Lucien all summer. I had the privilege of galloping a nice filly by the name of Pearl Necklace.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a multiple stakes winner that year. But Lucien was not going to Miami for the winter. He was going to South Carolina, and I wanted to go to Miami. I was sick and tired of being cold coming from the north of England. I wanted to go to this place that I've never been to called Miami, where they said it was beautiful during the winter. So I needed to find a job going to Miami. And a friend of mine was galloping horses for Calumet Farm at the time. John Beach was the trainer. My friend was galloping horses for him, horses like Al Mims and Devon Adale. And he knew of a trainer that I had never heard of that was looking for an exercise boy to go to Miami. And so my friend set me up with an interview the next day with this trainer. And I walked into this trainer's office, and it was Woody Stevens. And I'd never met him before. I'd never spoken to him before. I'd never heard of him before.
Wow.
Little did I know at that time that he was... And, you know, and in my estimation now, he was the greatest trainer that ever lived. And I walked into his office, and I said, because he knew Graham, the person that had set up the interview, so to speak. And he asked me one question. He said, do you ride as well as Graham does? And I said, Mr. Stevens, I ride better than Graham does. And he said, you're hired. And he said, I don't need to see you on a horse. I like your confidence. So... I just started galloping horses for Woody. And that was in, I would guess later in November, later in the year, probably November of 77.
Now, what was that like when you found out who Woody Stevens was and everything that he had accomplished?
Well, initially, you know, it took a while to find this out. All I knew was I was going to work every day and getting on these horses that each one was better than the next. These were just phenomenal racehorses. I've been around some nice horses back in England when I was there, but these were even better, and they were just getting better every year. And I was fortunate enough that he would put me on the better ones. And the list is endless of the horses that I galloped from the time they came in as unraced two-year-olds to the end of their careers. And I was just, again, blessed by being in the right place at the right time and working for Woody during his glory years.
Now, you were part of nearly all five consecutive Belmont wins, too, weren't you?
I was there for 82 was Conquistador, 83 was Caveat, 84 was Swale. And then I left in the spring of 85. So I was not there for the last two.
Did you gallop all those horses, too?
I had been on Conquistador CLO and galloped and breezed him, but I was not his regular exercise rider. The same with Swale. Ronnie McKenzie was the man, was the gentleman that galloped him most of the time, although I breezed him several times. But that year, we also had another three-year-old called Devil's Bag, who I was exercise riding while Ronnie was on Swale. Caveat, I took him to Hot Springs. We ran in the Arkansas Derby. So I was on his back a lot as well, Caveat.
What was that like going through that run of at least the first few Belmont winners and then following Woody's career after that, after you left? What was that like?
Well, it was great, you know. So by the time the third one rolled along and it was Swale, it was bittersweet, of course, because Swale met an untimely death a week after the Belmont. But it was just a phenomenal time to be around all of these horses. And don't forget, in between that was a little horse named Danzig that came along, and I was on his back every day of his life. He was a tremendous racehorse, probably the best horse I've ever been on. I would say equally him and Devil's Bag were probably the most talented horses that I've ever been around in my life. But Danzig went on to be a tremendous sire after having only three starts.
Trainer Phil Gleaves joining me on Trainer Talk presented by Fazit Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Phil, your relationship with Woody was very special. You went from not knowing who he was the day you walked into his barn to becoming very, very close friends.
Yes, we became very, very close, and he became like a father figure to me, and I looked up to him immensely. And just being around him was just a dream come true to go to work and listen to his stories, because as I got to know him more, he would regale myself and everyone else about his life, his stories with Captain Guggenheim and Never Bend and horses of that caliber and Cannonade winning the Derby, the 100th Derby. And Woody had some great stories and great insights into this particular industry.
Yeah, I'm sure you can remember, like so many of us can, exactly where you were the day you got the call or the news that Woody had passed away in 1998. That had to be very difficult.
It was very difficult. I was in Delaware at the time. I had taken my string to Delaware, and I wanted a change of pace, and the best filly I had in the barn, Rash's Warning, was owned by some people that were in the Delaware area, so I did not want to give that filly up, so I agreed to go to Delaware. But anyway, that's when I got the news and jumped on a plane right away, and I, along with several of his other former assistants, were his pallbearers, and never a day goes by that we don't think of Woody. He's in my house right now where I'm talking to you from. There are pictures of him just all over my office, all over the living room, everywhere.
What was the biggest or the main thing that he taught you that you're now employing in your operation today?
Well, Woody had a great grasp, and I'm still learning it myself, and it probably took him a long time to learn, and it's really taken me a long time to learn, too. He had a great grasp for figuring out how a race would be run. And there are so many people today, and myself included in the past, that want to just stick with the same game plan with a horse. So in other words, if this horse goes to the lead, if he went to the lead last time, he'll go to the lead the next time. If we take him back the last time, we'll take him back this time. Woody was not like that. Woody would play off how he thought the race would shape up. And so if there's a lot of speed in the race, then he maybe would take his speed horse back. If there was not much speed in the race, the horse that came that closed, he might want up closer to the pace.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a great knack for figuring out how a race would be run, and I think he would give credit for that skill from a man that he learned it from, Julie Fink, who was a big gambler and big owner back way before my time in New York.
So being so close with Woody, when you finally made the decision to go out on your own, I guess it was around 1986, how difficult was that decision, or was it one that you looked upon as being a very exciting time in your life?
Well, it was 85, actually, and I'd worked for Woody for several years, and the last, mainly, as I said, as an exercise boy, galloping, you know, six horses every day. But then the last couple of years, I asked Woody if I could do something different and become a foreman slash assistant and maybe just get on two horses a day and spend the rest of the morning on the ground in the barn learning the ropes. And he thought it was a great idea. He was all for it. So the last 2 years I was with him, I just galloped two horses. One was named Devil's Bag, one was named Sabin. And the rest of the time I spent on the ground following him around, following other assistants around, learning how to put bandages on, just doing everything. And so he knew, and we'd spoken about it, because we socialized a lot. So he knew that I wanted to do more than be an exercise boy. I wanted to become a trainer. And so I'd received a couple of offers from a couple of people to train, and Woody had said no, either because I wasn't ready or because he didn't really care for, he didn't think the situation was a good one. But then in the winter of 84/85, I got a call from Frank Stronach, and he wanted me to be his private trainer up at Woodbine. And I, the next morning, I told Woody about the phone call, and Woody made some phone calls of his own, because at that time, Frank was very well known north of the border, but not so much well known down here.
Mm-hmm.
And Woody came back and said, Phil, it sounds like this guy's a good guy to be with. You should go on and take the job.
Now, your career got off to a great start as well when you first went out on your own. You didn't waste any time getting started on a high note.
I was confident in my own abilities, and I don't mean that to sound arrogant, but I was confident. And the first two I ran, one won and one was second, got beat a neck. And within a month, we'd won a $100,000 stake for Frank. And it was an interesting time, and I spent the year of 85 up in Canada training for Frank and then for another gentleman named Rick Kennedy. But I want to be back in New York. I want to be back on the New York circuit. So I decided to open a public stable in the winter of 85/86 down here at Gulfstream. And I did that with four horses.
And was one of those horses a little horse by the name of Wise Times, or did he come along later?
As luck would have it, Mr. Reinemann, who owned Wise Times, was in the midst of changing trainers. And Mr. Reinemann had always had horses with Woody. I knew him well. He had always had private trainers in Chicago, and he decided he wanted to break the horses up into for several different trainers. And he sent me a couple of horses, and one of them happened to be Wise Times.
Wow. Wow, and all he did was go on and give you a few grade ones in that first year,
Wise
right?
Times, we loved him when he came in, and we ran him. You know, we thought he was a real nice horse, and it's just funny how things happen. We took him to Louisiana for the Louisiana Derby. He ran okay, but then during the summer when we went back to Belmont, I was trying to get a race to fill at Belmont, and it didn't fill like 3 days in a row, so I put him in at Monmouth because that race, it's just an allowance race, filled. And it was in the mud, and he won in a very, very fast time. And 8 days later was the Haskell. And, you know, coming from the Woody School, 8 days was nothing. he ran Conquistador back in 5 days. And so eight days, I didn't even give it a second thought. So I said, let's go for the Haskell. And as luck would have it, it rained, and he won the Haskell. Then it went to the Travis. It rained the night before. Woody and I had dinner the night before the Travis at the Wishing Well in Saratoga, and the rain was just coming down in buckets, and we're looking at the window. And he said to me, we'll have the Exacta tomorrow. And that was, and we did actually, it was through the DQ, but he had Danzig connection in the race.
Yeah.
He got put up to second. But Wise Times won that, and then a month later, he won the Super Derby down in Louisiana Downs.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about bringing horses back on short rest like that. Is that, Phil, is that kind of a lost art with trainers nowadays?
I don't know if it's I don't know if art is the correct word. I think that trainers, unfortunately, there are so many critics out there or so many Monday morning quarterbacks that are looking over trainers' shoulders. Every owner's got a racing manager. You know, so we're prime targets for criticism. So I think a lot of trainers would like to do it, but they don't want the ramifications of it backfiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, if a horse were to get beat, you know, it opens yourself
right,
up
yeah,
to saying, well, we
yeah,
brought him back
exactly.
too quickly.
Then, yeah, you've got six guys lined up talking to the owner saying, well, the trainer screwed up.
Yeah.
You know, and trainers just don't want to put them, and I understand it, trainers just don't want to put themselves in that position. But as far as the horses go, I don't think that we've changed the breed that much in 20 years that horses can't do it.
Yeah.
And certainly Dutro was doing it all the time. So it still can be done. But a lot of people just don't want to do it.
Trainer Phil Gleaves, my special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on HRRN. I know when things were going really well for you in the first stages of your career, when you first went out as a public trainer, I had read a quote somewhere where you said that you took it for granted back then, but you don't do that now.
I did take it for granted. Like I say, I was very confident in my own ability, and I just took it for granted that I'd be having Derby horses every year. I really did think that way.
Yeah.
And I got a rude awakening, obviously, because times got very lean.
Yeah, and that will humble you very quickly, won't it?
It will. It will. And then what it does, it just it makes you appreciate then when the next good one comes along, what a blessing that is, and how fortunate you are to have the good one. And so, yeah, it was a very humbling experience. It only helped me in my career because I just learned more and more from that, and on a personal nature, and also what to do with horses and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, you know, we as trainers, we are only as good as the horses that are in our stalls. It's as simple as that. There are 100 trainers out there that are capable of winning a Kentucky Derby that do not ever get the chance to have a horse of that caliber in the barn.
Yeah, and you did. Wise Times took you to the Kentucky Derby, and that had to be a very special experience for you, especially that early in your career. Did you ever think that you would get to that point that quickly?
Well, he did. He got me there in '86, and I think at that point I was the second youngest person ever to get to the Derby. I'm not sure if that record still stands or not, but I was very young. I was 28, and I was at the Derby, and I flew my parents over from England, and it was just a very proud moment. Even though we finished 10th, it was a great thrill to spend. There's nothing like Derby week. You know, there's nothing like the week leading up to the Derby being at Churchill Downs. There's nothing like it in sports.
Yeah, I've asked several trainers this question, Phil, but when you get to the Kentucky Derby, whether you win it or not, you've been there, you've been part of it. It's horse racing Super Bowl, if you want to look at it like that. Does it make you want to get back there even more in the years afterwards?
Well, it does. It does, you know, and there's a reason why the Baffetts, the Zitos, the Todd Pletchers, they want to go back year after year, because it is the pinnacle of our sport. It's a great showcase for our sport. It's just what you want to do. You want to perform on the big stage. And I was lucky enough to get back in 1990 with a horse called Happy Jazz Band. I haven't been back since. I'd love to get back there. When the right horse comes along, I will get back there. But again, it's all about the horses, Mike.
Talk a little bit about your team, because I've had a lot of trainers tell me that they can't do it without their assistants and without the people surrounding them. Talk a little bit about your team and some of the people that are very close to you and have been for a while.
Well, I'm very fortunate. I have an assistant trainer who I've known for 35 years and who worked with me for a long time at Woody's, and that's Sandy Bruno. She was an integral part of all of Woody's success during the years that we were talking about. She was also an assistant trainer. So she's been my assistant trainer for the last several years and does a tremendous job of being my eyes at the barn when I'm not there. I have an excellent exercise rider in Oscar Perez, been with me several years. I have a groom, Esteban Encarnacion, has been with me 16 years. So you can never underestimate the team that's with you, and you try to pick the best people that are available for your operation, and I've been lucky that way as well.
Yeah, I can imagine that consistency and the relationships you're able to develop with them has to be huge in helping you be successful.
Yes. Yeah, no question. You know, there are several components. The horse, as I've said several times during this interview, the horse is the most important component. You have to then have the staff. And, of course, you have to have the trainer to be able to train him and call the shots. So much can go wrong in this game. It's interesting. You know, when you get a horse to a race, that's a feat in itself, just getting the horse to the race.
Yeah.
Because so many things could have gone wrong. And so a large part of the effort is getting that horse to the gate in one piece and then hoping he's okay in the gate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's certainly not an easy game in that respect at all. Tell me about a horse, Phil, that's really stood out to you outside of some of the big names that we've talked about already, but another horse that's really stood out to you in your career.
One that I've been involved with, you think? Well, I've been involved with a lot of top horses. Terpsichorus was a great big Nijinsky filly that I got for Woody that won a bunch of grass stakes. White Star Line was a Northern Dancer filly that it just came to my mind right now. She came to us as a maiden in Hialeah one winter, and we were breezing these three horses all together every breeze, and she was always finishing last. And Woody would always say, this is the best one. And she would finish last in every breeze. And sure enough, he was right, because she rattled off the test in the Alabama. She was champion three-year-old filly. So she was a special filly. Swale, because of what happened to him, you know, as time has gone on, I've thought more and more about him and what a good horse and nice horse he was to be around for Claiborne Fauna. Devil's Bag was always my favorite. He was just a brilliant racehorse. Danzig was just as brilliant, but had his soundness issues. You know, every horse has their story. And I've just been fortunate enough to be around a lot of good ones.
Well, Phil, believe it or not, just a couple minutes left here. This has really flown by, as these interviews typically do here on Trainer Talk. But I always like to end by talking with trainers about what it is they like to do outside of horse racing, other interests that you might have in those few moments that you're not at the racetrack.
I'm a huge history fan. I love archaeology. I've been to Egypt. I've been to the pyramids. I've crawled on my belly through ancient tombs. I do love history. We watch Jeopardy as a family every night, and I can't wait to see if we get a history category. I'm passionate about breeding in racehorses. I think that will be my future. I don't see myself as being a trainer with a lot of horses. I see myself moving forward as a trainer with a few horses that I've bred and owned myself. One of my idols is Federico Tessio, who did that. I'd love to move along in that direction. My outside interests are spending a lot of time with my wife and my son. I play some tennis. I do a lot of different things.
How old's your son?
He is 14.
Any interest in being a horse trainer?
None whatsoever. I've tried to introduce him to horses in the barn, and he has no interest. I'm not going to push it. He's going to be a computer whiz. My wife, though, loves horses. Her father's a trainer in New York, so she comes from a horse family. So she enjoys the racing game every bit as much as I do, and we breed horses and own horses together.
Well, Phil, this has been an absolute delight. Can't thank you enough for taking the time, and want to wish you all the best moving forward. It's been great to hear your story.
My pleasure, and anytime.
All right, Trainer Phil Gleaves here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Some legendary names there. Not just Hall of Famer Woody Stevens, but you think about the horses that Phil had an opportunity to be part of working with Woody, and then, of course, moving forward on his own and to make it to a Kentucky Derby in his first year as a public trainer. Just a remarkable story. Great stuff from Trainer Phil Gleaves. If you missed any portion of the show, check out a podcast at horseracingradio.net, and you can catch us Thursday, Friday, Saturday here on HRN. Check out that schedule on our website. Thanks for listening, everybody.